clients are going to expect that attorneys are going to be benefiting or going to take advantage of the efficiencies that AI uses. And so an attorney, a law firm that doesn't use those is going to be at a competitive disadvantage.
Welcome to the award-winning podcast, Lawyer to Lawyer, with J. Craig Williams, bringing you the latest legal news and observations with the leading experts in the legal profession. You're listening to Legal Talk Network.
Welcome to Lawyer on the Legal Talk Network. I'm Craig Williams coming to you from Southern California. I write a blog named May It Please the Court and have two books out titled How to Get Sued and The Sled. Well, artificial intelligence has become one of the most discussed topics of our day. With the introduction of sophisticated chatbots like OpenAI's ChatGPT 3.5 and ChatGPT 4, many have predicted that we're on the verge of a revolution in terms of how many industries operate, including the legal industry. So what do firms and attorneys need to do to stay ahead of the incoming AI wave? Well, today on Lawyer to Lawyer, we're going to discuss AI and the law, the impact, and what the future holds for the profession under this new AI revolution. To help us better understand this issue, we're joined by John D. Villasenor. He is the professor of electrical engineering, law, public policy, and management at UCLA School of Law. And he's the faculty co-director of the UCLA Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He recently wrote a piece for Brookings Institutions titled, How AI Will Revolutionize the Practice of Law. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, how did you first become interested in artificial intelligence?
Well, my background is actually in technology. While I am on the faculty at the UCLA School of Law, my degree is a PhD in engineering. And I've long worked in the technological side of things. And in the last decade or so, I've also been working at the intersection of technology and law. And AI is a longstanding interest of mine. And I'm particularly interested in the ways that technology has these broader impacts in society. And it's hard to think of a technology that's going to have more of an impact on society than AI will in the coming years. So it's really a fascinating and important topic.
Can you explain what AI is for people that have never heard of it and don't understand what it is?
It's a really important question because the term is thrown around so often these days. But basically, and you can find different definitions if you look, for example, on the internet. But basically, you can think of AI as computer systems that have the capacity to learn and to engage in the kind of complex observations of the environment and responding to the information obtained from the observations to modify their behavior. So a calculator on a smartphone that just multiplies two numbers together, that's very fast. It's much faster than a person, but it's not intelligent. It's not learning. It's not getting better at that task as you do it more and more. Whereas an AI system will generally learn from the data, from its experiences, and become better at executing whatever task it's supposed to be doing.
What is it that allows a computer to learn?
Well, it's a combination of things. One thing is data. A computer, if it's properly programmed and it encounters a lot of data, then it can start adapting its behavior to the data. A simple example that I think many listeners will be familiar with is something like Amazon, which will recommend purchases, or Netflix, which will recommend TV shows or movies that you might want to watch. And what it does is it has seen, for example, in the case of Netflix, the type of content you watch in the past. And so it learns, for example, that maybe you like sports or you like action movies. And based on that previous behavior it observes about you, it then starts providing you with suggestions that it believes are, or it's concluded correctly or incorrectly, are more aligned with your interests.
So we've heard about GPT-4 and so consequently, there's probably a GPT-3 and a GPT-2. How long has AI been really developing?
Well, yeah, if you really go back to the origin of it all, you know, you can go back to Alan Turing, who back in, you know, in the 1950s was asking the questions of, can a machine think? Can a computer think? And AI research has been, you know, quite active. It's really since, you know, the mid-20th century, you know, it's been, you know, growing, obviously not as much in the mid-20th century and more as we get to the end of the 20th century. But we've seen an absolute, you know, hockey stick, you know, increase in the last, you know, two decades. And that's largely because the capacity, our computing capacity, the ability to have enormous amounts of storage, enormous amounts of data, and enormous processing power, that's all just gone through the roof in the last, you know, 15, 20 years, and particularly in the last, say, 5 years. And that's what's allowed this field to really take off and have an impact that it never had in the 20th century.
So there are some examples of that you've put in your article in the Brookings Institute that you think that AI can be used for discovery and writing briefs and doing research in law. How does that work?
So I think what's important to underscore, I think, is that the newest AI, the things that have been in the news so much and that, you know, people have seen examples of on in various publications, the newest generation of these large language model tools are truly a departure. They're truly different from the kind of technology, labor-saving tools that lawyers may have had in the past, right? And so, of course, things like digitizing data, the ability to store data digitally and look through the data and to search through it. I mean, that obviously revolutionized how everybody, including attorneys, interact with documents. But with these large language models, the AI, now we have AI, and that's capable of producing output that until now required a human to do. It's creative output. The tools before, you know, for example, like digital search, they did stuff very fast, but it wasn't creative. And so what you see now is these tools being able to do creative tasks that lawyers engage in and to, you know, help them do those tasks, for example, much faster than before. And I can provide examples of how it could be used in discovery if you'd like, but at a high level, it can do, you know, tasks that before now would have required a human to do.
So essentially, if you get a truckload of documents in an e-discovery response, you can upload those to a language model and then have that language model analyze those documents?
You can. Now, how good that analysis will be is an open question. I think it's important when we talk about this to distinguish between, you know, today's technology, which is extraordinary relative to what we had 5 or 10 years ago, but is really... it's in its infancy compared to what we're going to have 5 or 10 years from now, right? So, you know, you can analogize. Some of your readers may be old enough to remember the first internet browsers in the mid-1990s. And, you know, we all thought that was, I'm old enough to remember that. And we all thought that was really amazing. But of course, that was nothing compared to, you know, the internet that we now have today. So today, you know, these tools are probably nowhere near as mature as they're going to be. But I think in the not too distant future, yes, you will be able to have the proverbial truckload of documents and you'll be able to basically feed it to an AI system and have it perform analysis. Now, that doesn't mean you just push a button. You're going to have to know how to use these systems, you know, what queries to give it, what instructions to give it, how to know whether, you know, it may have missed something. And so, you know, it's not as simple as sitting back and pushing a button, but these tools will be able to do in extraordinary fast timeframes things that might have taken, you know, a team of attorneys, you know, weeks before to do.
In my uses of AI, I use a language model myself, ChatGPT-4 at this point, and it pretty regularly gives me misinformation and sometimes it makes things up. How reliable is AI at this point?
Well, it's a really good question. And I think, you know, certainly there's plenty of examples, including the ones that you're citing, where these language models can give information which just isn't true. And, you know, so obviously it would be foolish, given today's technology, for anybody to assume that the outputs of these models are, you know, what they say is necessarily true and you'd need to do due diligence. I also think that we shouldn't mistake the unreliability to the extent that it exists in some of the current models with something inherent to AI, right? If you look at the difference between, you know, the original ChatGPT release back in November, which I may be wrong, but I think that was based on what some people call GPT 3.5, and GPT 4, which is the version that just got released, you know, in the last few weeks, already there's an enormous improvement. I think GPT 4 easily passes, you know, a bar exam and, you know, nails the GRE, you know, verbal, you know, writing section, and, you know, does great on standardized tests, much better than ChatGPT's original release did. And so I would expect that as these models grow in sophistication, they will also grow in reliability. Although I would also say never to the point where it's always going to be a bad idea to blindly trust these on assertions that may or may not be true.
Right. I found that the research skills that I've developed as a lawyer over my career come in really handy when I try to develop prompts for the research that I'm doing. And I found that the results need to be checked, but are usually pretty good.
Yeah, that, I think that's a really good way. And that's, again, this is a snapshot of today's technology. And, you know, 6 months from now, it's going to be different. But even today, I think that's the right way to characterize it. Like, pretty good. You can't completely trust it, but really, it can save you a significant amount of time. And so even if 10% of it isn't good, well, the 90% of it that is good can save you, you know, quite a bit of time.
John, at this time, we're going to take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors. We'll be right back.
Join us at LegalUp on April 24th and 25th, hosted by InfoTrack. This fun and free virtual event will help you propel your legal career to its next phase. There's something for attorneys, paralegals, and for practice leaders. Join InfoTrack and One Legal on April 24th and 25th. Don't miss out on your chance to register. InfoTrack.com/LegalUp and get inspired.
Learn by doing with Practicing Law Institute's award-winning on-demand interactive programs. Developed by experts in learning design, these immersive programs incorporate the latest in research-based instructional design and technology, allowing you to try out concepts, challenge yourself, and grow your skills using real-world scenarios. With programs focusing on professional development, client-facing skills, and law practice management, you can earn CLE while you learn. Launch now at pli.edu/interactive or download PLI's mobile app.
And welcome back to Lawyer to Lawyer. I'm joined by Professor John Villasenor. He is the co-director of the UCLA Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy. We've been talking about artificial intelligence and its development. But today, the day that we're recording this, a letter got sent out by a bunch of tech hounds, I'm going to call them, I guess, asking for a pause in the development of AI. What's that about?
Well, the signatories of this letter believe that these large language models and the training of these systems is proceeding so quickly that it's really getting ahead of our ability to understand their behavior. And they're concerned that this is raising risks that are best addressed by basically taking our foot off the gas and giving it a pause and thinking about the sort of proper frameworks, potentially regulatory frameworks and otherwise to put around these. Now, not everyone agrees that that's the right approach, but that, as I understand it, that is the gist of the letter.
What do we have to fear?
Well, there's no question that AI, like so many other technologies, can be used for malicious purposes. And you can go analogize it to the internet in some ways, right? I mean, the internet has all sorts of extraordinarily positive benefits that we all know well. And the internet also has opened the door to all sorts of negative uses, like propagation of misinformation and financial crimes committed with the aid of using the internet and so on. So there are legitimate concerns about potentially malicious or unintended consequences of AI systems. At the same time, there's also extraordinary benefit. And again, this is like many technologies.
Right. Well, we've heard that there have been some deepfake issues, that there had been an instance where President Macron in France was seen on a video supposedly bashing his own programs. And same has been true for President Biden. What safeguards are in place to protect us from these things?
It's going to be a fact of living in the 21st century, or at least the 21st century, in the 2020s and beyond, that the technology to create deepfakes is out there. We all grew up in an era where if you see something on video, you could be confident that it actually happened, or pretty confident anyway. And that era has ended. It cuts both ways, right? In the sense that the fact is that when we see something on video, we are going to have to ask the question, how confident are we that this is depicting something that actually happened, or whether it's, or maybe it's a deep fake. And it goes in the other direction, in the sense that when something really does happen and is captured on video, let's say a politician is captured on video actually saying something, highly problematic, you know, then the politician might deny having said it and say it's a deep fake, and it, you know, it can create confusion in both directions. So it's a challenge. There are technologies out there that to varying degrees can try to detect these things, but it's a bit of an arms race, right? The detection technology improves, but then so does the technology for evading the detection. And I expect that pattern to continue.
Well, initially, you know, Google did not put out an AI and it didn't release it because it had some fears that it expressed kind of outwardly about the validity of AI. But then Microsoft put it out and ChatGPT came out and now we've got Bard. So are we moving too fast?
You know, I guess we'll have to wait a little while before we, you know, conclude definitively whether it's too fast. I mean, the glass half empty way to look at it is that, you know, this is too fast and we're arguably engaging in developing a technology of which the ramifications are, but that we don't really fully understand the ramifications. You know, the glass half full way to look at it is that the level of progress and investment that is going on in this space currently is truly extraordinary. And we are every day becoming closer to unlocking some of the extraordinary potential of AI. You know, I'll just give one example, you know, drug discovery. AI can be used to solve very complex protein folding problems, which in turn ties directly to drug development. And so there's another example is there's been documentation of AI, using AI to identify in medical images, tumors that human radiologists don't necessarily always catch. And so there's on the one hand, we don't want to proceed carelessly and then end up creating negative effects that are, you know, a problem. On the other hand, we don't want to hold back so much that we then delay access to new drugs, better medical diagnosis techniques, and the many other benefits that AI is going to bring. And so there is a tension there. And I don't know that anyone has the perfect answer on how to resolve that.
You know, the letter that we talked about earlier says that it's going to apply to the Federal Trade Commission and ask for regulations to be put into place. In your opinion, do we need regulations in place, laws? And if so, where should we start?
Yeah, so I'm hesitant to just say, you know, regulate, you know, without being more specific. And I think it's important to underscore a couple of things. First of all, while some of these technologies are new, there's already a lot of regulation that nonetheless applies. So I'll just give an example. Let's suppose a bank uses an AI system to make decisions on loan applications, and those decisions end up being biased against a protected class, biased based on, say, race or gender or something like that. Well, of course, that would violate the Fair Housing Act, right? So the Fair Housing Act, although it was enacted obviously without specifically thinking about, you know, with AI in mind, it would still apply if an AI system is used in a manner that violates the Fair Housing Act. So if you look across these different domains, I think you find that there's a lot of law and regulation in place already that can address some of the negative potential consequences of AI. So I think the better question to ask is, well, what other negative possible consequences are there of AI that fall outside the regulatory framework to the extent that a framework is necessary to address them? And if we can identify a set of these things, then, you know, it's a sensible thing to at least discuss regulation. The other thing I'd like to say, if I may, is that regulating in the tech space is particularly complicated because there's always the risk of unintended consequences, in the sense that you can, you know, draft a regulation or enact a new law that targets a particular concern that you have, and maybe it does a reasonable job at addressing that concern, but it can create collateral damage in other ways. And I think that's really important to keep in mind always when regulating the tech space, and particularly in relation to AI.
That and the regulations seem to be outdated almost as soon as they're issued.
You know, it is a real challenge. On the flip side, when you know, Congress tries to sort of get ahead of things with regulation, that can go sideways as well. A brief anecdote: in 1986, Congress enacted the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which, among other things, provided that emails stored more than 6 months are far less protected from a privacy standpoint than emails stored less than 6 months. And the logic was, well, back in the mid-1980s, who would store emails for very long because you were going to run out of storage space? And that law is still on the books. And so, you know, it's an interesting example of how, you know, trying to regulate to a particular point in time can you know, end up being hopelessly outdated. And you might think, oh, well, you know, Congress can just fix the law. But, you know, Congress hasn't fixed that law, and we're coming up on 40 years.
That's a real problem. So let's talk about how attorneys use AI. I mean, should attorneys start to use AI? Are there any ethical considerations? Do we need to disclose to the client that we're using AI?
Well, a couple of things. AI is obviously a broad term, and there are going to be good AI tools and not so good AI tools. So, of course, it's going to be always important to use any of these tools in a manner that honors any of the confidentiality restrictions that might, you know, be associated with the information that's being, you know, provided to these tools. So that's, you know, that's, you know, you don't want to take, you know, confidential client data and, you know, basically, you know, paste it into a window that's just being, you know, gathered by some, you know, entity that you have, you know, no relationship of confidentiality with. So there's those sorts of issues. I think there's a balance here. I don't think attorneys should sort of assume that AI is going to do everything they've done before much better, because I don't think that's true. But I also think it would be a mistake to assume that AI doesn't have a role in the modern practice of law. I think especially as the technology develops, it's going to be a time-saving tool that is beneficial to the attorney, because the attorney can produce an end product like a, you know, like a motion to file with the court, or a document to update a client on the status of a legal matter or a new contract. It's going to be able to help the attorney do those things a lot faster, a lot more efficiently. And clients are going to expect that, right? Clients are going to expect that attorneys are going to be benefiting or going to take advantage of the efficiencies that AI uses. And so an attorney, a law firm that doesn't use those is going to be at a competitive disadvantage.
Well, John, it's time to take another quick break to hear a word from our sponsors. We'll be right back.
It can be frustrating to wade through the malpractice insurance application process, but you know you need to protect your firm. Alps designed their application to be flexible, easy, and 100% online. Fill it out, review your quote, accept, and pay in as little as 10 minutes. Alps is the nation's largest direct writer of lawyers' malpractice insurance, and they are endorsed by more bar associations than any other carrier, so they understand law firms. They also know how valuable your time is, and that's why they make legal malpractice insurance easy. Visit alpsinsurance.com to learn more. That's alpsinsurance.com.
Filing court documents, serving legal papers, collecting electronic signatures, all critical parts of the litigation process, yet ones that are time-consuming and error-prone. But what if you could do more straight from your case or document management software? InfoTrack automates data entry, document selection, tracking, and information syncing across all these core tasks and more by integrating with your core systems like Clio, Smokeball, Leap, MyCase, and others. Spend more time on substantive legal work and less time on busy work. Learn how simple it can be at infotrack.com/simple.
And welcome back to Lawyer to Lawyer. I'm back with John Villasenor. He's a professor at UCLA, Law and Technology. We've been talking about AI and how attorneys use AI. Let's talk about copyright issues and plagiarism. Anything to worry about there?
Yeah, there is. It's a complicated issue. As some of your listeners may know, there's actually some lawsuits ongoing right now in relation to images. There's some AI systems that can generate images. You know, you can give it a prompt like, you know, portray a picture of, you know, two cats playing chess and things like that. And it produces these really interesting photorealistic images. And so there's some lawsuits right now from companies. I believe Getty is a plaintiff in one of the lawsuits, Getty Images, and basically alleging that the makers of at least one of these image producing AI systems violated copyright by basically using their images as training data for that process. So there are interesting open legal questions with respect to, and they're not resolved. The courts have never addressed these before, and you know, statutory law is silent really. It's really a question of what constitutes fair use, and of course, the case law on fair use doesn't give us a definitive answer to these questions. So I think copyright is important. You know, plagiarism, obviously, you don't want to plagiarize, you know, another attorney's work. At the same time, it's often very common for, you know, the same text or almost the same text. You know, let's say an attorney is, you know, submitting a motion before a particular court, and in doing so, the first several pages of the motion might cite some of the relevant case law from, you know, that circuit, or if it's a federal court, or from the Supreme Court. I mean, multiple different filings in different cases can still reasonably use the same kind of background information on particular motions. So I don't know that I would call that plagiarism if they're using, you know, prior work from their own firm on different cases. So I don't think reusing text is always necessarily a bad idea, as long as it's done in a way that doesn't violate any ethics laws or ethics customs.
Well, let's talk about the classic situation. You and I are both old enough that we remember when the internet started. So that means that we probably have kids or know of kids that are using these things these days. What about an assignment from a high school teacher that says, draft an essay on this, and you prompt the language model to give you a result and you turn it in? Is there a problem with that?
Yeah, I've actually, you know, I published a piece in Scientific American a couple of months ago where I explained why in my class at UCLA School of Law, I tell my students they're free to use ChatGPT in their writing. And what I also tell them is that they are solely and fully responsible for anything they turn in under their name. So if it's partially plagiarized, they've committed plagiarism. If it's logically or stylistically inconsistent, then that's on them. If it's factually wrong, that's on them as well. But I do think, again, I know not everyone agrees, but I think, you know, for students today, and this is true for high school students, college students, graduate students, these students are going to be practicing. You know, it's extraordinary. If you do the math, and I find it stunning every time I do it, but these students can be reasonably expect to be practicing into the 2060s and 2070s, right? That's way down the road. And that, you know, the mid-21st century, AI is going to be a tool. And we should teach them to engage with it responsibly and ethically and productively, not to be afraid of it. And that's the philosophy I bring to my teaching. And that's what I think the best approach is. I understand some other people don't view it that way.
We've seen the robot in court trying to get out of a red light ticket as an attorney for a particular defendant. Will we see AI take over as attorneys?
You know, AI, there's a lot of things AI can't do, right? AI can't make a convincing, you know, presentation to a jury. AI can't motivate a team of attorneys to produce their best work. AI can't possibly replicate the human element of client relationships, which is such an important part of law. So there's a lot of things that AI can't do. I don't think we'll see a day where, you know, a trial consists of, you know, two robots arguing back and forth in front of a judge or a jury. And so I don't think we'll see that. But I do think we'll see AI playing an increasingly significant role in the information that gets, how documents get produced. I'll just give you another example. You can imagine in a trial, you can imagine an AI engine analyzing the transcript in real time and using the results of that analysis to suggest questions that, say, an attorney might want to ask in a cross-examination, for example. So I think you'll see AI being used in lots of different ways, but not to replace the human element, which is such a profoundly important part of so many careers, including law.
I'm just waiting for the political cartoon that comes out with two robots in a courtroom talking to a robot judge.
Yes, that would be strange. I don't think we have to fear that. I don't think that's coming anytime soon.
What do law firms need to do to get ahead of the curve on AI? I mean, I know that I'm using it for research, I'm using it for writing, and I'm even some marketing techniques. What do you suggest?
I think it would behoove a law firm to make sure there's somebody in the firm and perhaps a few people in the firm who are really tracking this technology and, you know, understand what product offerings are out there, what product offerings are in, you know, on the roadmap going to be coming out soon. It's like any other field. There's going to be a lot of competition, a lot of startups, and a lot of new products. Some of them are going to be really great. Some of them are going to be less great. Some of them are going to be really expensive. Some of them are going to be less expensive. And I think, a law firm shouldn't be flying blind in that environment. And I think it will be important to have knowledge about the state of play of these tools and then to make decisions, obviously, about which tools to adopt, because it's, you know, it's complex. You know, if a law firm's going to adopt a particular tool, there's a cost associated with that, there's a learning curve, there's a switching cost. And you know, you want to be, you know, prudent in that respect as well, because you can, you know, if you're switching tools every 30 days, well, that's going to create all sorts of inefficiencies as well. But I think it would be a mistake to ignore it. You want to track it and understand how it can, you know, potentially help your practice. That's what I would do if I were in charge of making these decisions, which I'm not.
Other than the class that you're teaching, are you aware of any other law school classes or classes that are out there where people can learn or attorneys can learn how to use AI?
Well, I saw an announcement today for I think it's a one-day program somebody's running about AI and the law. And I would expect that there are people sort of furiously, you know, spinning up courses and products and things right now. And I think we're going to be, you know, and I would imagine venture capitalists are probably investing in new tools. And I think we're going to see a burgeoning ecosystem of tools and opportunities to learn about these things. And again, it's going to, you know, people are going to have to be discerning consumers. It's not all going to be good, but there will be good stuff out there that if you're discerning and find the right stuff, will provide an opportunity for people who want to learn more about this to do so.
You know, not that I want to promote any one particular one beyond the ones that I'm using, but your Brookings article mentioned.
It mentioned there was a company called Casetext.
Casetext.
Which has a product called CoCounsel. And I should emphasize, I have absolutely no financial relationship of any kind with this company. So I'm not mentioning them out of some sort of conflict of interest. I just found it interesting in the sense that they, at least according to the news releases, they have some sort of relationship with, with OpenAI, or at least access to those, some aspect of those large language models, which, and you know, we all know how good those large language models are. And they've offered a product which they claim can help make legal research much more efficient. I would expect that they are one of what will almost certainly be many companies offering products in this space. But the fact that they're out there already is sort of an existence proof that this is an area that entrepreneurs in the legal tech space are seeing real opportunity in.
Right. Well, John, it looks like we just about reached the end of our program, so it's time to wrap up and get your final thoughts and your contact information.
Okay, so anyone who's I'm easy to find on the internet. I'm on the faculty at UCLA, and so people could send me an email at UCLA if they want to do that. It's villa@ee.ucla.edu, and that's public information. It's on the website there. Yeah, so that's how I could be contacted.
Great. And what are your concluding thoughts? How do you think we should help people to think about this?
You know, I think it's an extraordinarily interesting and important development, these latest developments in AI, and not just for the practice of law, but for society generally. It's going to impact, you know, have extraordinary impact across many different sectors of society. It's going to be very, very interesting to see how this develops. And I think we, you know, if you look at the stunning progress we have seen just since late November, it's hard to even imagine, you know, the things that we'll see in the next 6 months, year, 5 years. So it'll be interesting. And I think we'll see some really, really fascinating and important tools that are going to, you know, they'll have obviously some downsides, but we're going to see some enormous benefits from this technology as well.
Great. Well, John, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure you having on the show. We'd like to thank Professor John Villasenor from UCLA for participating today.
Thank you very much.
Well, here are a few of my thoughts about today's topic. Attorneys in my day used to print out emails and have their secretaries dictate their responses to their secretaries, and then the secretaries type up the response and send the email. Those days have long gone. Attorneys are expected now to be able to function with technology. And if you're still in that category, it's time to get ahead of the curve. Jump in, download ChatGPT-4, or look at it online, start to put in some research queries and figure out how to use it. If you don't know how to use it, perhaps take a class, but as Professor Villasenor says, it's coming and you need to be ready for it. Well, that's it for today's rant on this topic. Let me know what you think. If you like what you heard today, please rate us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcasting app. You can also visit us at LegalTalkNetwork.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter. I'm Craig Williams. Thanks for listening. Please join us next time for another great legal topic. Remember, when you want legal, think lawyer to lawyer.
Thanks for listening to Lawyer to Lawyer, produced by the broadcast professionals at Legal Talk Network. Subscribe to the RSS feed on LegalTalkNetwork.com or in iTunes. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Legal Talk Network, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.
The Lunch Hour Legal Marketing Podcast, your resource for the tips and tactical advice you need to grow your business. Plus, keep up with the news and commentary you crave to stay one step ahead. It's hosted by me, Guy Sakalakis.
And me, Conrad Song. Every other week, we break down the issues holding back your marketing strategy and talk about the changes you need to be prepared for. Check out the Lunch Hour Legal Marketing podcast wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.